Well, I want to thank Tony for the opportunity because there's less people. And you remember last time I was going to preach, I was telling you that I wanted to pray in the morning and my kid's brother played rocket ship. Well, this morning I wanted to run through my sermon one more time, and it turns out that my daughter was highly intensive, high maintenance, and then turns out I couldn't even bring her here because she has some rash on her bottom. Took her over to the neighbors, and after I dropped her off, their dogs promptly chased me off the property and bit me in the leg. So I didn't know that preaching was hazardous to your health, so I just want to warn you in the future. Our topic is fanatical forgiveness, and those are two words that you usually don't seem to go together. When you think of the word fanatical, a lot of times you think of maybe Muslim extremists who are bombing things. Or fanatical, you think of these Christians that ram the gospel down people's throat and won't quit, and when they see them coming, they run. But usually you don't think of the words fanatical and forgiveness both together. But today that's what we're going to be studying, and Tom's going to show a video to get us started off here.
I ran into this guy that I know the other day whose wife has left him for another man. And this guy, he's like still wearing his wedding ring, and he's got kind of the hopeful, you know, hey, we're going to make it through this kind of feeling. And he's trying to kind of convince himself that it's going to be okay, but it just doesn't look like she's coming back. And this other friend of mine, she was telling me that, like, she doesn't really have the same kind of beliefs as her family. And every time she goes to a family reunion, she said they all just turn on her. And they said they just get mean and angry. And she says, it just gets ugly really fast. And she leaves in tears every time. It's like everyone I know has wounds. And some are small, kind of petty, like, you know, you just need to get over it. But a lot of people, they're big and serious and deep wounds. I was talking to this girl I know the other day, this friend of mine, and partway through our conversation, she just says, she's like, you know what, I was raped. It's like we could speculate why all this happens and why people do these kinds of things, and we could try to figure it out forever. But I think what we want is to be free from this, don't we? It's like we want to be alive and healthy and whole. I mean, I don't want what somebody else did to me to, like, determine what my life is going to be like. Do you? Because sometimes it's like big things and sometimes it's small things. Maybe for you it's just like an offhanded comment by somebody you don't even know, but maybe it was somebody that you really loved or that you still love and they left you. Or like maybe like just a business partner who took the money and ran, or a relative who abused you, or a friend who like turned on you. And it's like you try not to think about it, but then if you're like me, then you end up thinking about it more than ever. And it's like we want to put this stuff behind us, but how? Or have you ever had this happen? It's like you think you're over it, you think you're okay, you think it's in the past, and then you either run into the person or you run into something that reminds you of them and what they did to you, and then it all comes back like worse than ever. And it's like you thought you were over it, but now you're more into it than ever, and the wound is like reopened and it hurts more than ever. And then it becomes a day or a week or 10 years later, and now it's become like a part of you. It's like you can't shake it and can't leave it behind. And so then eventually what happens is revenge becomes our only hope, and we aren't free. Like, I don't know what you're carrying around. I don't know how painful it is or how heavy it is or how long you've been carrying it around. But my question, or I think our question, is always, where was God when this happened to me? In the book of Psalms, it says that God's eyes are on the nations. And the book of Proverbs in the Bible, it says that the eyes of God are everywhere. So whatever was done to you, whatever wrong was done to any of us, God saw it. It's like God was right there. In this book of Romans chapter 12, the writer says, don't take revenge, but leave room for God. It's like the writer says, just turn it over to God. Let God take care of it, which is... It's like a nice idea, but it isn't very easy to do, is it?
Isn't that often where we find ourselves, is that forgiveness is a great idea, and it's not always easy to do. Let's see what Jesus has to say about this in Matthew 18, 21 through 33. It's Matthew 18, 21 through 33, the familiar story of the parable of the unmerciful servant. Then Peter came to Jesus and asked, "Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother when he sins against me? Up to seven times?" And Jesus answered, "I tell you, not seven times, but 77 times." Now at this point, Jesus tells the parable. And whenever he tells the parable, it's a common rabbinic tradition that anytime you tell a parable where there's a king and servants, the king represents God, or represents Jesus, and the servants represent us. So as we read the rest of this, think of yourself in the place of the servants, and what is it that God's trying to tell you that he wants you to do and the way his kingdom works. "Therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. As he began the settlement, a man who owed him 10,000 talents was brought to him. Since he was not able to pay, the master ordered that he and his wife and his children and all that he had be sold to repay the debt. The servant fell on his knees before him. 'Be patient with me,' he begged, 'and I will pay back everything.' The servant's master had compassion on him, canceled the debt, and let him go." Let's stop right there. Matthew 18, 21 through 35 here presents two reasons why all Christians should forgive each other. Two reasons why all Christians should forgive each other. First of all, this first section that we just read, the first reason is incomprehensible compassion to us. This compassion to us that we totally are unable to understand. Let's start back over again. First of all, Peter is asking a question, should we forgive our brother up to seven times? Now, he's hung around Jesus long enough to realize, hey, I think I get this guy. This guy's about forgiveness. And the common rabbinic standard at that time, the common standard of the rabbis, was three times. You should forgive somebody up to three times, and you're a pretty good person. So Peter goes a lot further. He says, should I forgive my brother up to seven times? And Jesus said, no, up to 77 times. Obviously, he was exaggerating for effect. And he's basically saying an unlimited amount of times. We should forgive somebody an unlimited amount of time. And then he decides to tell this parable to illustrate this principle. Now in verse 4, he says the debt that this guy owes is 10,000 talents. Now, a lot of times where we make the mistake, if we preach on this or commentators talk about this, is they try and exactly translate 10,000 talents into our amount today, and they'll say this million, that million. But the problem is sometimes when we get into exactitude, we miss the point. Basically, the highest known currency at that time was a talent, and the highest number in Greek was 10,000. So if we really want to compare what that would be like today, the highest currency today is a dollar. And the highest known number that we can think of, what would that be? I mean, we know that there's billionaires out there. Gates is so many billions. So probably the highest number that we can reasonably think of is $1 trillion. So basically, this guy was in debt $1 trillion. Now, obviously, this is ridiculous. He's exaggerating to make a point. And at this point, the disciples are even probably chuckling to themselves a little bit, because everybody knows that no Near Eastern king worth their salt would ever let anyone get this far in debt. They would kill them long before this. Otherwise, if they let them get into this kind of debt, they would be disrespected by all the other kings in that land, and they would probably be attacked, because they would see this guy must be really weak to let him get into this kind of debt. So he's making a point. Remember, God is the king, and we are his servants. He's making the point that we are in debt to God an infinite amount, $1 trillion worth. Now it says, as he began the settlement, a man who owed him 10,000 talents was brought to him. And Like I said, conceptually, this is about $1 trillion today. Now, a lot of you, like me, maybe grew up in a nice home, you never been to jail, never thought you've never done anything that wrong. So how can I owe $1 trillion to God? How can I owe so much? And I haven't done anything really that terrible. I haven't murdered somebody or something like that. You know how that's, you know, how we often use that argument in our heads. And I think there's a couple of things wrong there. First of all, we have a very small view of God. We sort of think of murderers here and us here and God's here. And we have a very limited view of God. Actually, probably a more correct view is murderers here, us here, and God's right around the sun. That's how much more holy he is than us. But we use this argument in our head, well, I haven't done anything really that terrible. The problem is our understanding of God is way too small. Our view of God fits in our own little small world. And God is so much holier than us, so much greater than us, that we're not so different. We owe God a lot. A second reason why we owe God a lot is because we have underestimated the cost of forgiveness in our life, that Christ died on the cross for our sins. And I finally got this one time when I was 18. And being young and 18, I wasn't very bright. And I was playing water polo. That was the sport I was playing at Stanford. I had been invited to Stanford to play with them. And the coach, so he can get me up there, offered to have me work. I was just, you know, raking his yard. And he had bought this new land. And there was a lot of dirt and basic area that just needed to be hoed down. So he brought me there, but one of the things he said, now look at this square area. I want you to hoe all the weeds in this area, but I don't want you to touch two areas. Right here in these two corners, my wife and I planted these little small bushes that are one day become trees, and we planted those when we got married, and that, you know, that represents our marriage. So I said, sure, no problem. So I was very careful, and I was going and going, and then lunch came. And then I went back, and it was one of these very hot days. It was something like 100 degrees. And this was over in California, and I was hoeing away, and I just wanted to finish, you know. So I started hoeing faster and faster and faster, and it got hotter and hotter and hotter. And then all of a sudden, about 3 o'clock, he comes outside, and he just goes, "Oh, Randy!" He goes, "What did you do?" And I looked around, and I had hoed a path right through one of the trees that him and the little bitty trees that him and his wife had planted. And so I went, "Oh, Randy, what did you do?" I said the same thing, and I just covered my head, and I went, "Oh." Now, was I a terrible, awful person? No, I was an 18-year-old idiot. But what I had done is that I had taken something that was priceless to him. And there was no recovering for that. That's the same way. If Christ dying for us, he's priceless. So sometimes we focus on, well, I'm not so bad. But what we forget is the cost to God was infinite. That Christ is God himself, and so he has an infinite value. It costs God everything for us to spend eternity with him. Now, verse 26 says, "The servant fell on his knees before him. He be patient with me, he begged, and I will pay back everything." The man was desperate. He knew he could never repay this debt in his lifetime. He was just grasping at straws because this man was going to sell off his kids to help pay for the debt, sell off his wife, and put him in jail. So he was just desperate. He's willing to say anything. And he fell to his knees, and he said, "Please, I will pay back everything." But the guy who forgave him knew there's no possible way he could forgive that he could ever repay $1 trillion of debt. But what did he do? He said the servant's master had compassion on him, canceled the debt, and let him go. Now, this word compassion is not an accident. It's the same word that Jesus that was used of Jesus. Now, remember, this king represents Jesus. In Matthew 20:34, it says, "Moved with compassion, Jesus touched their eyes, and immediately they regained their sight and followed him." Mark 1:41 says, "Moved with compassion, Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him and said to him, 'I am willing, be cleansed.'" This king represents God that forgave us for a debt that there's no way we could ever pay back. It cost him everything. It cost him his only son. And there's no way we could ever pay him back. Now, what would you think would be a normal reaction to that? I would think that this guy would be just crazy and overjoyed. And he would be going out telling all his friends just how much that he was forgiven. And I tried to think, you know what? How can we experience this? What illustration actually gets this across of how much we as Christians have been forgiven by God? And I thought, Scrooge, this guy understands forgiveness. Now remember, Scrooge was visited by three ghosts, right? The ghost of Christmas past, the ghost of Christmas present, and the ghost of Christmas future. The ghost of Christmas past took him around and showed him how bad he was and showed him all the mistakes that he made in the past. The ghost of Christmas present took Scrooge and showed him how evil he was and showed him all the people that he had hurt in the present. And then the ghost of Christmas future finally took Scrooge around and showed Scrooge not only the people that he hurt, he actually showed him some people that would die because of him, because of not sharing his money, that some people would actually starve to death. And then the last thing that the ghost of Christmas future showed Scrooge was his own grave and his own funeral, and only one person showed up, his former employee, that he had no friends. And he started screaming, no, 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 and then all of a sudden he woke up. But he was unsure if this, he had this dream sort of like state on Christmas Eve, over into Christmas. So he's unsure, am I dead? You know, am I in hell or something? Or is this real? And so he gets up out of bed, he runs to the window, and he yells out, and he says, what day is it? And this little boy says, Christmas. And he realizes he's got another chance. I'm forgiven! Woohoo! I'm forgiven! I'm forgiven! Woo! I'm forgiven! I have a chance! I am forgiven! I have another chance! Now, shouldn't we be acting that same way as Scrooge? He thought he was going to die. He had another chance. He was a crazy guy. He went out in the streets. He threw money at people. He gave away gold coins. Until we are in touch with the depth of how much we've been forgiven, we're not going to be able to share that with others. So what does this guy do? I mean, we expect him to act like a nut. We expect him to go out and be really forgiving. But what does he do? And this is our second point, the reason to fanatically forgive as Christians. First of all, his incomprehensible compassion. The second one, though, is if we don't get that, the incomprehensible condemnation that's waiting for us if we don't forgive. Verse 28, but when that servant went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii. He grabbed him and began to choke him. Pay back what you owe me, he demanded. His fellow servant fell to his knees and he begged him. Now listen to this exact same wording that he used earlier. Be patient with me and I will pay you back. But he refused. Instead, he went off and had the man thrown into prison until he could pay the debt. When the other servants saw what had happened, they were greatly distressed and went and told their master everything that had happened. Then the master called the servant in. You wicked servant, he said. I canceled all that debt of yours because you begged me to. Shouldn't you have had mercy on your fellow servant just as I had on you? In his anger, his master turned him over to the jailers to be tortured until he could pay back all he owed. This is how my heavenly Father will treat each of you, unless you forgive your brother from your heart. So how did the servant respond? There was somebody that owed him 100 denarii. 100 denarii is 100 days' wages, 3.5 months' wages. This is nothing compared to $1 trillion. This is nothing compared to a lifetime that this guy could never pay back this king, this debt, and yet he couldn't forgive a guy for a three and a half month debt. How evil was his heart? Notice that the same request for patience. However, instead, what was his response? He threw the guy into prison until he could pay back the debt. Now, note the irony there. How much can somebody pay you back if you throw them into prison? Zero, right? Sin makes you stupid. Unforgiveness makes you stupid. It makes you, the more unforgiveness you have in your heart, the more twisted you become, and you become more interested in inflicting pain on the other person than you actually do to get paid back what you owed. And isn't that what we do sometimes? We're more interested in inflicting pain subtly or overtly, sometimes subtly. How many times do we not forgive our spouse, give them the cold shoulder treatment, the silent treatment? We're taking revenge. We're paying them back. We're not forgiving them. And yet the cycle continues, and actually it causes, it's worse for us. This Pastor Rob Bell has some more to say about this issue of revenge and taking revenge yourself.
It's because, like, revenge is like part of our world, isn't it? I mean, we talk like this all the time. We'll say things like, you know, I'll settle the score, or I'll teach them, or they'll learn not to mess with me. I mean, we talk like this all the time. But think about revenge. Think about revenge like at the deepest spiritual levels. I mean, revenge is really saying to God, God, I don't trust you to deal with this situation. This person wronged me, and I can't turn it over to you because I don't know what you're going to do here. And so revenge is like saying, God, not only I don't trust you, but if I get revenge, then I can determine what happens here. I can control the situation. And so revenge is like saying to God, I don't trust you. I actually think I can do your job better than you can. And some friends of mine, the other day, we were talking about this idea of what revenge really is at the deepest spiritual levels and how it's just an insane way to live. And my one friend starts telling this story. He says he used to have, like, golf balls in the glove compartment of his car. And so he'd be driving down the road, and somebody would, like, cut him off or do something in traffic that got him mad. So he'd pull ahead of them, and then he'd pull in front of them, and then he'd take the golf balls out of the glove compartment, and he'd, like, toss them out of his sunroof, hoping that they would, like, dent the car that had cut him off. And we're all laughing. But we've all done things like this, haven't we? Like, completely crazy things because we were just so bent on revenge and evening the score. And revenge doesn't satisfy, does it? I mean, have you ever really evened the score? I mean, have you ever really gotten revenge and then felt good about yourself? It's because revenge doesn't work, does it?
Revenge does not reflect the compassion of God. This passage says that if you do not understand forgiveness, maybe it's because you haven't received His forgiveness, that your heart has not changed, that you're not a true son or daughter of God. It's not that you've lost your salvation, but there's a question: were you really ever saved? If you really don't understand to the depth of your soul that you've been forgiven, and that, you know, we should be the craziest people running around throwing forgiveness at people, like I threw those dollar bills, throwing love at people. Look what Matthew 5:44 says. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For He makes the sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet only your brothers, what are you doing more than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? And we're not only to forgive when others ask, we're to proactively seek to forgive, to initiate. Matthew 5:23 says, so if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you. So this is during a worship service. If you're in the middle of a worship service and you have a gift to give, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. What he's saying here is, if you have unforgiveness at your heart, what are you doing coming Sunday morning and worshiping? He's saying that forgiveness is so important to me that forgiveness is worship. Forgiveness and reconciliation is so much the heart of God that there's no better worship than you can have. So he says, I want you to stop what you're doing Sunday morning. If you realize Not that you haven't forgiven somebody, but you realize that somebody has something against you and you haven't taken the initiative to bridge that gap. Amazing, isn't it? He's not even just sitting there saying, oh, I have unforgiveness in my heart, I better run out. This is saying, if I know somebody has something against me, stop what you're doing and go out. Because what you're doing here in worship means so little to me if you're holding unforgiveness in your heart. So again, forgiveness and reconciliation is just as much worship as sitting here singing. Wow, that's amazing. Forgiveness is what Christians should be known for. Not long before she died in 1988, in a moment of surprising candor in television, Margarita Lasky, one of our best-known secular humanists and novelists, said, "What I envy most about you Christians is your forgiveness. I have nobody to forgive me." We should be known for our forgiveness. I want to ask you something. Gandhi once said, "I would be a Christian except for the example of Christians." I would be a Christian except for the example of Christians. He was so impressed with who Christ was and so unimpressed with Christians. And I know Steve got up here and he talked about how bold that we should be to share the gospel. But one thing I want to point out is, how bold are we to live the gospel? If people don't see forgiveness in our hearts, if we're hurt by people in our family, you know, or people that we work with, and we don't forgive, what kind of example is that? Why would they want to become a Christian? Yeah, they'll really respect Christ, but are the people around us going to be like Gandhi, who says, "I would be a Christian except for the example of Christians"? That is an amazing challenge for us. Now, what does verse 34 says? It says, "This servant would be tortured for the rest of his life since he could never pay back the amount." What does that sound like? Sounds like hell, doesn't it? And again, I think he said, if you want to be true sons or daughters, that forgiveness should be a way of life. And in fact, I think he's saying, not that there aren't periods where we have rough times forgiving people, but I think he's challenging us and saying, if you can hold bitterness and resentment in your heart long term, and that seems to be easy for you, do you really understand, you know, God's forgiveness? Did you ever experience it? That, you know, that's a challenge from us, you know, for us. Now, if I would stop there, it would seem like it'd be a really nice sermon and tied up in a nice little ribbon, and we could all go away. But I have to admit to you guys that I've really struggled with one issue of forgiveness for a couple years, and I haven't succeeded at it yet. Several years ago, my daughter died, and she was stillborn on Mother's Day. And it was extremely, extremely difficult for my wife and I. And three weeks after that, my pastor pulled me aside, and I thought he was going to put his arm around me and ask me how things were going, and he hammered me. He hammered me about the job I was doing. And that's something that I've never forgot, and I still struggle with to this day. And I'm just confessing this because I can't give this sermon and have any kind of integrity and tell you that that's not something that I still struggle with. And it's something that I think has cost me somewhat, and, you know, somewhat in my family. And it's not something that I'm proud of, but it's something that I think once in a while, Pastor Tony and, you know, people like me, we have to come to you guys and say, you know what, I need your help. I need your prayer. And that's what I'm asking for, is that you guys pray for me that I can finally put this to rest. I think I'm like 90% of the way there. But part of the reason why I wanted to confess that is because oftentimes we can come up here and give little simplistic sermons and really not understand what it's like when you just don't feel like you honestly want to forgive, and trying to is like trying to stop a tidal, you know, a tidal wave that's going over you. So I came up with, I think, from, you know, just a general perusal of Scripture, maybe three reasons why it's difficult for us to forgive. The first one, I think, is the one that applies to me and can apply to some of us, and it's maybe the only legitimate reason, is a wounded heart, that we can't heal from the hurt by ourselves. And sometimes it takes time. Sometimes it's a process. Sometimes you need counseling. Sometimes you need the prayer in conversation with friends. You need a process like Corrie Ten Boom describes. Corrie Ten Boom told of not being able to forget a wrong that had been done to her. She had forgiven the person, but she kept rehashing the incident, and so she couldn't sleep. Finally, Corrie cried out to God for help in putting the problem to rest. His help came in the form of a kindly Lutheran pastor. Corrie wrote, "I confessed my failure to him after 2 sleepless weeks. And what he said is, he said, 'Look up in that church tower,' and nodding out the window. 'There's a bell which is hung by pulling on a rope. But you know what? After the sexton lets go of the rope, the bell keeps on swinging. First ding, then dong, slower and slower until there's a final dong and it stops. I believe the same thing is true of forgiveness. When we forgive, we take the hand off the rope. But if we've been tugging at our grievances for a long time, we mustn't be surprised if the old angry thoughts keep coming for a while. They're just the ding-dongs of the old bell slowing down." And so it proved to be. There were a few more midnight reverberations, a couple of dings when the subject came up in my conversations, but the force, which was my willingness in the matter, had gone out of them. They came less and less often at last stopped altogether. We can trust God not only above our emotions, but also above our thoughts. And also trust God that sometimes forgiveness is a process. A second reason that we have a hard time forgiving, and this is a false reason, is wounded pride. That we've thought too highly of ourselves. And somebody has injured us, but all it does is injured our pride. It hasn't really wounded our soul. And we just need to get over it. A third area is what I call a wounded image, and that's a false one where we think too lowly of ourselves. And that's sin as well, that we shouldn't think too highly of ourselves, but humility is thinking of ourselves as God thinks of us, thinking of ourselves accurately, not too lowly either. And so sometimes we get stuck in that when we shouldn't. Well, one of the best examples that I've ever heard of forgiveness, it came from somebody I know, actually. It came from one of my professors. He was saying that one day a long time ago, his daughter was at school, and she called him. And she said, "Dad," she goes, "I need you to come and pick me up." And this guy's a pastor as well as a professor. And I don't know what she did. He was protecting her confidentiality enough to where he didn't say, but it had to be huge because she had to be picked up that day. So it was either she got pregnant maybe, or she did drugs, she got caught selling drugs or doing drugs in school, whatever. But she had to be packed up and gone out of the school that day. So he went and packed her up and brought her home, and she lived with him for a while. And she apologized that day, and she felt really terrible. And she started improving a lot and changing her life around. And a year later, she went up to her dad one time and she said, "You know, Dad," she said, "I never really realized the depth of how much I hurt you as your daughter, and also you're a pastor, and how much what I did actually hurt your reputation and everything." And she said, "I'm really, really sorry." And you know what he did? He just said, cocked his head a little bit, and he said, "You know what, honey? I'm sorry. I just don't remember that." May we forgive like that. Amen. Father, I just thank you for this time. I thank you for how much you've forgiven us, more than we can ever, ever imagine. That we have an unpayable debt to you, and I just pray that we would react with fanatical forgiveness like Scrooge did, just running out into the streets of our life, throwing love, throwing forgiveness at people, because we have been forgiven for so much. Thank you for the priceless death of your son. In your son's name, amen.